Good afternoon. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Jack Caldwell, who is a political reporter, writer, columnist for the South Bend Tribune for many decades, and he contributes to the Howie Politics Report. This time, he has a column in. It's entitled Joking with President Trump. We'll find out more about that. And we also have a conversation with Robert Colangelo, who is with Green Sense Farms in Portage, about his vertical farming operation and how it's picked up an Innovator Awards from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. And we'll also have a report as well, too, concerning the latest needle exchange project south of us. Jack Caldwell is a political science reporter, writer, columnist for the South Bend Tribune, has been for decades, and that's decades with a capital D, by the way. And he writes a lot of things as well, too, that you can see on Howie Politics Indiana if you subscribe to the website. One of his latest columns that is out talks about the fact that maybe people have only discovered for the first time that President Donald Trump is not much of a jokester. In fact, the column is entitled Joking with President Trump, which almost doesn't seem like much of a headline anyway. Jack is with us today. Hey, thank you very much for spending time with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Well, the column, I don't want to give everything away because I want you to explain it, but I got to at least get the first sentence out. The first sentence of the column, by the way, which is byline South Bend, because that's where you're based out of with the
right.
Tribune. It starts out with, most people can take a joke, some can't. Tell us how you came across this notion that our new president is not much of a jokester.
Well, I've thought that a number of times before, and what really caused me to write a column about it is a new book out, Devil's Bargain. It's by a correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week, and he tells about a situation back at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011. It was on April 30th, and at that event, the president at that time, Barack Obama, was delivering some humorous remarks, as presidents often do, and Donald Trump was in the audience, and he directed most of his barbs at Donald Trump, and Trump was not a happy camper. I happened to be watching that live, that broadcast of the correspondents' dinner, and saw how Trump was humiliated. Really, as the whole room was laughing
wow.
at the jokes. And in this book, The Devil's Bargain, the author poses the question: did Donald Trump run for president because he couldn't take a joke, because he was so mad at what Obama said about him that evening?
What's an interesting concept. I wonder, now that you mentioned, I wonder if you went to YouTube, if somebody happened to have posted, if they recorded that, I'm sure, because it was live, you could probably see the whole thing again if you looked for it properly.
Yes, and it, as you know, Barack Obama really had a good sense of humor, and he could display it well. And he really lit into Trump. This was right after the president had finally brought forth the long-form birth certificate from Hawaii, proving that he was born in the United States,
mm-hmm.
in Hawaii. And he really hit the Trump on that. in fact, had a video, musical video introduction, had American flags flying and eagles screaming and things of that sort, like something really big was coming up. And then it displayed his long-form birth certificate. And, of course, that's what Trump long had said was non-existent.
Right.
And then he really, one example, you know that Donald Trump is with us tonight. Now, I know he's taken flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter, like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And the crowd just loved it. They were roaring with laughter.
Now, if you will, and you mentioned this in words in the column here, describe, if you will, for us, the expression on Donald Trump's face all through this this conversation, or I guess, or his response to what he was hearing from President Obama.
Yes, it was described in the book by Joshua Green, the author of this best-selling book, Devil's Bargain, and I remember it specifically. I think he captured it perfectly. First. Of course, the cameras kept focusing on Trump as the jokes were being told about him. First, he had kind of sort of pasted on half grin, and then the grin went away, and he just stared sort of frozen, didn't laugh, didn't show any signs of any type of response, except just sitting there humiliated. And it went on, well, not only with President Obama telling jokes, then Seth Meyers was the master of ceremonies, and he came on with even more jokes. He said one example was, Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic, because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. The Donald didn't join in laughing about that.
I can just imagine that whole table or wherever he was sitting was probably just stone silent.
And, he was at, by the way, the Washington Post table.
Oh.
He was invited, and he, according to the book, I didn't know this part, he actually canceled another engagement to come back, because it was such an honor to be at the Washington Post table for this this big prestigious event.
I feel sorry for the folks, other folks at the table. They wanted to laugh, I'm sure, and they couldn't dare laugh because he was there.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember just their reaction, but as I recall, others at the table were more smiling, but I mean, they weren't just laughing uproariously like people at other tables all around the room.
I wonder what other Republicans have had to say. Certainly if they've seen this book or they've heard about this book, I wonder how they would feel, and especially those who were probably in the room, maybe just as visitors, guests, of course, of other media tables as well, too. I wonder what they have to think about this conversation that the president made during his speech, the reaction to everything on Donald Trump's face and his demeanor at the time, and how that's kind of played out into what we face every day today.
Well, I think there certainly is a correlation. I think still President Trump, just as perhaps about to be candidate Trump at that time, doesn't take kindly to any type of criticism, any type of fun being poked at him. He certainly, I think, he cannot take a joke. He just doesn't like to be joked about. Furious about Saturday Night Live.
Well, I was going to say, just imagine how he feels about Alec Baldwin doing his impression of him, his constant impression of him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He had a number of tweets about that. He doesn't like people to joke about him. And he doesn't exactly laugh it off himself very much with jokes. Most of his comments are not joking, but they're very, very pointed and often very nasty.
Well, even the Bushes, and I guess even going back to Ronald Reagan, would crack jokes sometimes. Maybe there weren't as many as you might possibly think, but in some cases they could poke fun at themselves if they wish, or they certainly could take a joke. Apparently, better than our current president.
Yeah, right, Chris. I think most of our presidents were known for, not all of them, but for having sort of a sense of humor and being able to, you know, kind of dish out their criticism in a joking way, as well as taking some of the criticism. Presidents traditionally have gone to that correspondence dinner, and most of them know they're going to be the subject of a lot of barbs there, and they usually smile about it, and maybe it does hurt a little bit. But then they get a chance to respond, and they do in kind with humorous remarks, and they poke fun, usually at themselves, which is something Trump really can't do. And they'll poke fun at the news media, of course, and political figures who are in the room, and other important people who are in the room. And I don't know, Obama seemed to really enjoy it, taking some of the barbs and then dishing it out afterward to other people and critics like Donald Trump.
We're talking with Jack Caldwell, who is a veteran reporter and writer and columnist for the South Bend Tribune, as well as his columns show up on a regular basis on Howie Politics Indiana. We're talking about Jack's column this past week that came out on the website that refers to a book that is entitled Devil's Bargain. It was a good bestseller about President Donald Trump and his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, written by a reporter for Bloomberg Newsweek, I guess, or a correspondent.
Yes.
Joshua Green is this fellow's name. You can check out the book in more detail if you like, but you'll find some interesting things in there about the Trump campaign, I'm sure, and about the Trump administration and people in the campaign and in his administration here, and in particular this one instance where it shows how little of a, apparently, for at least as best we can tell now, much of a sense of humor that Donald Trump has, yeah. Apparently either before he became a candidate or now he's become president. How does this seem, in your opinion, seem to fare for the rest of the administration as we continue on in the Trump administration?
Well, I think what you see is what you get. You know, the people keep talking about, well, will Trump become more presidential? Will he change? No, he won't. I think Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He is determined to do and follow through with what he's doing, and I just don't think he's going to change. And certainly, he didn't go to the first correspondence dinner of his term, and I'd be kind of surprised if he goes to any during the time that he is president. He doesn't like that sort of thing, and nobody's going to be able to convince him that he should develop a sense of humor.
Well, he certainly won't after that incident on April 30th, 2011, to be sure.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, and you talk with a number of Republicans as well as Democrats,
sure,
about this, and I'm sure that the Republicans feel a bit uncomfortable about the fact that the president does not have much of a sense of humor. Democrats, I'm sure, are probably delighted that he doesn't, but Republicans in particular, I'm sure, are probably chagrined about that.
Well, I think so. I think they were really hoping that Donald Trump would change, become more presidential, less thin-skinned, and not want to slap back with tweets at any criticism. But I think they should realize now he is not going to change. They're going to have to live with Donald Trump, who is in the White House, and hope that they still can accomplish some things, and that he won't get us into a lot of trouble, places like North Korea and some really serious things because of his determination just to slap back and insult rather than maybe.
Well, and on top of that, too, you still have all the efforts in his administration, certainly to say the least, health care. But we now have tax reform, and we have some other important points that we know that the administration's wanted to make some definite changes and having to work with Congress on that. And we know what's happened so far as health care is concerned. But there's a lot more ahead on the agenda than it's going to take some difficult, not only decisions, but difficult conversations. And I suppose you need to have a sense of humor to be able to deal with some of these.
Well, I think that would certainly help, and Republicans in Congress are going to have to try, as they are trying, to get some things accomplished and get some legislation passed, and then their hope is that President Trump, whether he has really helped or hurt in their efforts, will at least then sign these into law, and there is a chance that he will. And if they can accomplish that, they probably will not worry about whether he has a sense of humor or not.
Jack Caldwell is a veteran reporter. He's covered Indiana politics and also kept an eye on the national political scene as well, too, for five decades for the South Bend Tribune, and also for Howie Politics Indiana. And Jack, we really appreciate you spending some time talking about your latest column, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana is handing out more Innovators Awards for the month of August, and one of them is going out to an organization that is known as a farm here in Northwest Indiana with a different purpose to it. Green Sense Farms is based in Portage, and we have with us the guy who owns it, Robert Colangelo, who's picked up the award. Robert, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Tell us a little bit about what the farm is all about, how you got started, and what prompted you to seek out a goal of sustainability here in Northwest Indiana.
I've spent my whole career in the environmental industry, working on innovations and bringing capital to ideas to make the world a better place to live. Maybe it sounds a little trite, but that's what I've done. And I came across the idea of indoor vertical farming around 2008, and I went through the Thomas Edison phase of figuring a thousand ways on how not to build an indoor vertical farm. And finally, we hit on some ideas, which we basically integrated existing systems that were proven in a new application. And now we've got a system that we've perfected that we're working to replicate around the world.
For folks that aren't familiar with what vertical farming is, I think maybe we think of something like that, trying to envision in your mind a big potted plant, basically. In this case, it's a crop that's growing in a plant or something like that. What is vertical farming all about?
The easy description would be thinking about walking into a large walk-in cooler. Something that's 25 feet tall, 60 feet by 60 feet long and wide. And we have a pallet racking, which stacks 10 to 14 levels high. And on those racks, we have tubs that are 4 by 8 feet. And within those tubs, we have 16 trays that can hold anywhere from 105 to 6 plants. And we give those plants everything they need to grow perfectly. We give them the right amount of nutrients, the right amount of water. We shine LED light 18 to 22 hours a day on these plants. And then we control the temperature and humidity and airflow so they have perfect conditions and they can grow rapidly. That's what indoor vertical farming is, mm-hmm. where you control the environment and you control the inputs so that you grow very perfect plants.
Now, what kinds of crops are you growing there in the vertical farming concept, and in turn, how much are you expecting to come out as far as your yield from the crops?
We grow microgreens, baby greens, culinary herbs, and lettuces, and we try to sell those live because plants are much more nutritious when you harvest them at your home mm-hmm. instead of cutting them and having them travel 2 or 3 days. So we produce somewhere between 2 to 3 million plants a day. And as I said, our goal is to build a national brand that's nationally known and locally grown by building a network of farms around the world. And we're focusing first on the U.S., Canada, Scandinavian countries, and Asia Pacific.
We're talking with Robert Colangelo, who is the creator and owner and operator of Green Sense Farms. They're based in Portage, and this interesting vertical farming concept is his, and he's expanded it at the farms here in Northwest Indiana. And in turn, he's picked up an Innovators Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana for that. I understand that you want to do not only expansion around the United States, but overseas, too. Tell us how you'd like to be able to move this concept not only from Northwest Indiana, but elsewhere.
What we found originally why we located in Portage, Indiana, was we were 20 minutes away from the Whole Foods Midwest Distribution Center, mm-hmm. which served 8 states and 48 stores. But we found that being so close to the store but not on the property meant that we could have been 100 miles away. We still had to schedule trucks and coordinate logistics. So what we found is by putting these farms at grocery store distribution centers and at institutional campuses, wherever large volumes of meals are served, that we can really have a disruptive business model that cuts out packaging, reduces food miles traveled, also reduces the failure of the cold chain because it's going from the farm to the customer, and it makes it much more sustainable. So that's our international model, is to put these at grocery store distribution centers around the world and at large institutional campuses, colleges, military bases, hospitals, and corporate campuses, wherever large volumes of meals are served.
I understand you've already expanded into sections of central Indiana, and you're planning, I guess, or you're in another space in the South Bend area is under construction. Obviously, you have opportunities here in the United States, but tell us how you've been able to get some interest overseas with this concept.
Well, we've been fortuitous and had lots of stories by the media, over 100, and that has generated a lot of global interest. So we were thrown into rock star status of indoor vertical farmers through all that media attention, which we greatly appreciate. And that has elicited numerous inquiries. We probably get 100 a month from around the world asking us to build farms or to partner with companies to build farms. So that's really what generated it, was all the media interest. And people have recognized that we're a market leader. There's a number of people entering the market, and we've been able to be successful. I tell the story of, do you know the difference between pioneers and settlers?
What's the difference?
Well, pioneers have the arrows in their back, and settlers get all the land. And when you're a new startup company, it's nice to be a pioneer, but you have to, you know, make that transition from being shot at to getting the land. And we've made that transition in the last 8 years since we've come up with this idea.
Robert Colangelo is the owner and operator, creator of Green Sense Farms in Portage, and expanding not only across Indiana and the Midwest, but around the United States and overseas as well with the vertical farming concept. And because of that, he has picked up the Innovators Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. Robert, thank you very much for spending time to tell us a little bit about the vertical farming concept, about Green Sense Farms, and good luck in the future, and hope you pick up another Innovators Award as you expand the business and the idea of vertical farming to every place around the globe. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, I just want to give a big thanks and a shout out to John Davies, who runs is one of the people involved with the program, and also Chancellor Cooley at Ivy Tech, who, after giving us award, we became friends, and he was really the impetus for us to get our farm built up on the South Bend campus and create an earn-to-learn training center and graduate much-needed job-ready graduates to work in the food service, ag, and produce industry.
Well, consider
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and consider it done. Appreciate you taking time to talk with us today. An exhibit at the Indiana State Fair allows visitors to hear how the Hoosier State has changed over the last two centuries. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports that the exhibit is made possible by a new branch of science.
Soundscape ecology is changing the way scientists understand ecosystems, says Purdue University ecologist Ben Gottesman.
We use sounds to tell us about landscapes and the animals that reside there and how places change over time.
Like where species migrate in response to climate change, or if habitat restoration projects successfully provide a new home for animals. Gottesman says people might be surprised by how rich Indiana's soundscape was before settlement.
We are in the sound booth, just listening to some scarlet tanagers and other songbirds. Now, the gray tree frogs and some spring peepers are emerging as it turns to night. Great horned owl, bam, a mountain lion.
Today, says Gottesman, those sounds have largely been replaced by farm animals, wind, insects, along with planes, trains, and automobiles. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
Valparaiso Community Schools is going through a construction and renovation process at many buildings, a program that includes the construction and now opening of a new elementary school, the first one to be built south of U.S. 30 in a growing area of the city. Superintendent Rick Fatasha was with us on Regionally Speaking before Sunday's ribbon cutting at Heveland Elementary School to talk about all of the ongoing building projects. Projects, he says, began after a successful campaign to seek community support for tax increases.
We had two referenda. One referenda was to upgrade the schools in terms of their infrastructure and obviously the classrooms as well. So we did, and we upgraded all of them. And for that, we raised, the community let us raise about $160 million, and we began the project in 2015. Now, our first school in completion will be Heavlin Elementary School, south of 30 on Heavlin Road, and we're very excited about it. We're going to do a ribbon cutting on August 13th at 2 o'clock. I'd love to have you there. We invited our patrons and sent out information about the ribbon cutting. But we have a lot of work going on at the high school that won't be finished until next July. And Cook's Corners and Memorial Elementary Schools are being added on to so you can accommodate more kids with the redistricting. And they'll be completely finished by Christmas, but we're not going to redistrict the kids into the schools that aren't completely finished at the start of school.
Mm-hmm.
So Cook's Corners and Memorial will be finished at Christmas time. The remaining schools are under construction now in terms of renovation, and the rest of the district will be done also next July. So this will be a pretty intense two-and-a-half-year project that our community enabled us to do, and what the community will have is a whole new set of schools at the end of it by next July.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing left would be the natatorium and some work on our backfields at the high school.
As I recall, when we first talked about this was back at the time when you were explaining to the public the referenda and the reason that the Valparaiso Community Schools was asking for it. You mentioned that it's just a case where the schools at the time were wearing out and they need to be improved, with the exception, of course, of the need for a school south of US 30. And when we remember talking at the time about the fact that the Valparaiso Community Schools had held the property for years. I don't know if it was necessarily, I guess, in the works of having a school built there anytime soon, but you want to have the land on hand just in case, and this is obviously that opportunity that's finally come up.
Well, your memory is terrific. I think it was probably four superintendents ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told that Mr. Phillips, who was the superintendent at the time, 40 years ago, believed that one of the areas that Valparaiso was going to grow in the future was south of 30. And so he purchased the land that we built the school on. And so 40 years ago, the land was purchased with his vision, and it's served us well. It saved us a lot obviously we didn't have to buy as much land, and so that saved us considerable amount of money in the referendum.
Now, in retrospect, do you think that maybe that he was a bit of a visionary, or did he know in talking with people that there would be an idea that someday that there would be such expansion south of US 30? It just at the time, nobody seemed to think of it.
You know, I think in all seriousness, Valpo as a city and school corporation has been blessed with folks that look to the future and see what's Valpo going to look like and need in the future. And I think he is one of those folks. I never really met him.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard interesting things about him, his love for Valpo and his knowledge of the area. And that would be an interesting mix, because at the time, 40 years ago, I mean, that's 1977. I came to Valpo in 1987. So he had made those purchases when Valpo wasn't nearly as developed as it is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what people think of the new school. What kind of reaction have you gotten from the public as the school was being constructed, and especially people that live on that side of the highway, seeing of a new school go up in their neighborhood, so to speak?
Yeah, great question. Well, typically you get a lot of interest at first, a little bit of nervousness about mm-hmm. how the school is going to impact the area in terms of traffic, kids running around, and that sort of thing. Then when the school begins to take shape and becomes more real, and they see that, it's not just, you haven't just put a rectangular brick building in their backyard, and you build it so you can invite the kids back to school after school and on weekends, we've gotten a really terrific response. the area, given its geographic location, asked if we could build an oversized gym instead of an elementary gym, so that we can provide those services for a wider area. And it is going to probably be our biggest, our most populated school. Mm-hmm. So we redesigned our initial design, obviously, and put in a larger gym that they requested. Also, we put in emergency utilities in the event that we have an ice storm like we had, 10, 12 years ago, mm-hmm. that if the community can find its way to the school, it'll be able to be heated and they'll be more safe. We did the same thing to three other schools strategically placed in the school corporation so that the townsfolk can get to those gymnasiums and cafeterias to warm up or cool off. Both middle schools have that emergency, and so does the high school. Mm-hmm. So with those four, we think we can take care of an awful lot of the community in an emergency.
That's Valparaiso Community School Superintendent Rick Fertasha. Classes, by the way, began today for the 2017-2018 school year. Tippecanoe County's health department officials on Friday tried to bar reporters from the public building where the county's needle exchange had been operating. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stan Drastrebski was among those reporters, and he has the details.
Reporters were able to talk with public health nurse Kayla Hochstetler until a few minutes before 1 p.m. Friday, when she then claimed they had to leave the building. But because Tippecanoe County decided to start its program over the objections of Lafayette and West Lafayette officials, it had to be in a county-owned space, one that by definition is open to the public. Health Department Emergency Preparedness Coordinator Ryan Tennyson spoke to the health department's lawyers, who tried to fall back on state law.
Probably in the bill related to this program, it specifically talks about media interaction, all that.
However, neither the original legislation from 2015 nor the 2017 addendum to that law says anything about media access. Tennyson also claimed the presence of reporters would dissuade those seeking clean needles. However, WBAA's reporters had been stationed inside the building, so they were not visible to program participants until those people walked inside. And as journalists sat in an adjacent room to Hochstetler's desk, two people did come in asking about the program. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stan Jastrzebski in Lafayette.
After fewer than 6 minutes of discussion, the Indiana Commission for Higher Education approved Purdue University's plan to merge with online educator Kaplan University. The ICHE is one of a handful of organizations that have to sign off on the merger before it can be officially proceeding, and the educational offerings of the two institutions may become one. Higher Education Commissioner Teresa Lubbers admits that her organization doesn't have all the facts about how the two colleges will coordinate, but she says that the commission was more interested in seeing a message sent that approves of an attempt at some type of innovation.
Had the commission acted in a way that would have decided to sort of not proceed with what is an innovative proposal that has the promise of serving students in a really promising way, and we erred on, I think, on the side of saying we believe that this should go forward at this point.
Some detractors of the project had hoped that Purdue University would miss out on at least one of the necessary approvals and that this idea of the union would fade away. But so far, all of those procedural votes have gone in Purdue's favor. The project has been shrouded in secrecy, except for a few documents filed with federal financial regulators. Purdue University President Mitch Daniels has defended the initial behind-closed-doors negotiations as necessary to making such a business arrangement work. Others have noted that the Indiana General Assembly slipped some 11th-hour language into the state's state budget that would create a legal loophole that would allow colleges to be able to create so-called public benefit corporations that would skirt most of the state's public records laws which otherwise apply to Purdue and other public colleges and universities. Daniels has decried these sunshine laws as unnecessary in this case because he argues that they deal primarily with the oversight of taxpayer dollars, which he says aren't at issue in this deal. But the argument is huddled and muddled now by another statement that the Purdue University president's frequently made and that he's encouraging current Purdue professors, whose jobs are partially taxpayer-funded and are subject to sunshine laws, to reach additional students through the Kaplan online platform. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
When you tune in to Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, or you stream us online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, you hear a lot of amazing programming, local news about Northwest Indiana that you won't find anywhere else. The highest quality of trustworthy news through NPR's seasoned national and international reporters, and countless hours of quality music and entertainment. I'm Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations, and I want to let you know the one thing you don't hear on Lakeshore Public Radio is advertisers. This station is a community licensed nonprofit, meaning no advertisers, no shareholders, and no financial backers. While this can be a good thing in that it means we can remain independent, it also means we absolutely must be able to count on our local base of listeners to pitch in with financial support. While Lakeshore Public Radio has made great strides to reach a level of support that is sustainable, we've yet to meet that mark. If you've been listening for some time but have yet to donate, or perhaps you're considering increasing your support, please do so now at lakeshorepublicradio.org by clicking on the red donate button. Your contribution really is the lifeblood of public radio, and the station cannot serve the region without you leading the way. Thank you for your support.
On this Regionally Speaking, we have part number one of a three-part series for you, taking a look at Indiana's public defense system. A lawsuit alleges that Johnson County in central Indiana isn't meeting its obligation to provide adequate representation. Indiana doesn't have a statewide standard to determine whether someone qualifies for a public defender. It's left up to each individual judge to make that decision through a series of questions. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier takes us to a parking lot outside the courthouse in Franklin.
William Carey just walked out of the Johnson County Courthouse, and he's trying to hold it together.
I'm just tore up. I don't know what else to say.
Carey appeared this morning for a pretrial hearing. He faces several charges, including operating a vehicle while intoxicated as a habitual offender. Today, an attorney with the Johnson County Prosecutor's Office offered him a plea deal.
What's going through my head is my freedom. You know, this is my life. And they're going to give me 8 years. You know, either sign this or I'm giving you 8 years. So I had no choice.
Carey had no legal representation because a judge determined at a previous hearing he isn't indigent and therefore doesn't qualify for a public defender. Carey broached the issue again at today's hearing, telling the judge he was representing himself because he makes about $250 per week and can't afford an attorney. The judge asked Carey what he spent that money on. Here's how the conversation went, according to court transcripts.
Because you've got no expenses, you're living with your parents.
Well,
They are feeding you. They are housing you.
I help them out with groceries, you know.
No, I'm not buying that. You live at home. Your parents are taking care of you. That's the way it works. I'm not stupid.
I'm not saying...
So what are you going to do with all the money instead of hiring a lawyer, which you said you were going to do?
I'm just, you know, expenses.
Carey signed the plea agreement. He agreed to plead guilty in exchange for the state dropping some of the charges against him because he saw it as his only option.
It was wrong. I have no legal representation. I don't know nothing about the court system.
Indiana doesn't have a statewide standard to determine whether someone qualifies for a public defender. It's left up to each individual judge to make that decision through a series of questions. Johnson County Superior Court Judge Lance Hamner says he doesn't think that's a problem. He's confident those who qualify for a public defender, at least in his county, are granted one.
So we'll hold a hearing and make a determination based on their income, based on the family income, based on the resources they have available to them, for example, the property they own and things like that, to determine whether, as a matter of law, whether they are indigent.
But Indiana Public Defender Council Executive Director Larry Landis says the definition of indigent is too broad and is applied inconsistently. It means someone who might qualify for a public defender in one county could be denied representation in another.
The test in Indiana is called the substantial hardship test, and it simply means can the person accused of a crime afford to hire a lawyer without imposing a substantial hardship on himself or his family? And there is no, you know, simple objective test of how much income or assets do you have, because it depends often on the severity of the case.
And that's not the only way public defense differs across Indiana. Yes, the Constitution requires states to provide a public defense system for its citizens, but Indiana passes that responsibility onto the counties and leaves it up to them to deliver on the promise. That means there's a lack of consistency across the state, and Landis argues, a lack of quality.
We've got a system that is broke.
The legislature set up the Indiana Public Defender Commission in 1998, which establishes standards for indigent defense. It offers a reimbursement program for counties. If the county agrees to follow the standards set forth by the commission, it could be reimbursed for up to 40% of the costs of non-death penalty felony cases. But just more than half of the state's 92 counties abide by the standards necessary to qualify. Landis says about one-third of the counties in the state don't participate at all.
Counties don't like to take state money because they perceive strings attached to it. Even though the strings are really protecting the public defenders, the quality of representation, because you have caseload standards, compensation standards, experience requirements for certain kind of appointments.
Johnson County is among those not participating in the state's public defense reimbursement program. That means it doesn't have to follow the commission's caseload or training requirements. Judges select private attorneys and then contract with them to handle public defense cases in their courtrooms. Landis says that setup creates a conflict of interest.
We would never tolerate a judge being an employee of a prosecutor or a prosecutor being an employee of a judge. But for some reason, we tolerate the advocate for the accused person to be an at-will employee of the judge. And then if you want to take an appeal, and you usually on appeal are alleging that the judge made a mistake, did something wrong, denied the defendant a fair trial, you got to appeal your boss and claim that the boss screwed up.
But Judge Hamner insists it's never caused issues in Johnson County.
The judges in our county, and myself included, expect zealous representation on the part of the attorneys that we appoint as public defenders. I would never expect them to back down in any way from us in any way. We wouldn't ask them to. We wouldn't want them to.
Johnson County Prosecutor Bradley Cooper doesn't see a problem with the inconsistencies in the public defense system across the state. He says the attorneys who represent indigent defendants here are among the best.
Whether you're poor or rich, you have the same set of constitutional rights. And those constitutional rights, at least in this county, are absolutely given to everybody that comes before the court.
But two lawyers are appealing a recently dismissed lawsuit that claims Johnson County is failing to fairly represent people here facing charges. Here's attorney John Little.
What our clients experience in this lawsuit is sitting in jail for months without ever seeing their attorney. They would see him in court for a minute or two where the attorney would ask for a continuance, and then the attorneys do literally nothing.
The lawsuit claims in one instance, a part-time public defender in Johnson County was assigned more than double the maximum number of cases allowed by the state's Public Defender Commission. But prosecutor Bradley Cooper says the fact the lawsuit was dismissed speaks for itself.
I thought the lawsuit was ridiculous, yes.
It isn't the only lawsuit challenging the quality of public defense in Indiana. A lawsuit is also pending in federal court that challenges Allen County's public defender system. Landis says many of the issues aren't confined to one county.
It's not about bad lawyers. It's about they have no resources, they have no independence, they have inadequate compensation, excessive caseloads. It's going to impair quality of representation, and it does.
As for William Carey, a judge sentenced him to more than 700 days in jail as part of his plea agreement, but that sentence was later modified to just over 450 days of work release. Still, Carey is left questioning a system built on the premise of fairness. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
It's Monday. Means it's time for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are two artists affiliated with the Art Barn in Valparaiso. They are Julia Holmes and Claire Reed. And welcome, ladies.
Hi.
We're very happy to have you here to talk about the Art Barn. So let's situate it first. Where is it?
It's off of, it's in Valparaiso mailing area, but it is actually located outside of the city and on 695 North, 400 East.
Oh, that, I know exactly where you
You know exactly where we are.
Yes.
Big old red barn.
Uh-huh. Well, I know there's that, hence the name. Or I don't know which came first, the barn or the name. Well, really, how long has the Art Barn been around? I've always known of it.
Sullivan's bought the barn probably 60 years ago, the farm, which has now come to the Art Barn organization. But 40 years ago, Jan Sullivan decided to make it into an art retreat, an art center, an art school. And so it's been an active art center for 40 years.
Yeah. And it's nonprofit.
Nonprofit.
And Jan passed away, sadly, a year or so.
Last year ago.
Yeah. And she was a hysterical guest. When I used to do these interviews on TV here at Lakeshore Public Media, she was hysterical because they had to fish the microphone up through your dress. And, oh, my Lord, it was a caution. But anyway, so you have something coming. And so Julia, you're on the board.
Yes. I'm the vice president in charge of events and programs and classes.
And you and Claire are both artists.
Yes.
And Claire, what is your involvement with the Art Barn?
Well, I am employed through AmeriCorps, and my job at the Art Barn is as a volunteer coordinator.
Okay.
So I try to bring in people to volunteer and to become engaged at the Art Barn. And I'm also an instructor. Watercolor instructor.
Nice.
We both instruct watercolor classes alternatingly.
Yeah.
Right. I assume that there's a very small staff, paid staff,
at the
Art Barn. One person.
Okay.
So you have something coming up that you're organizing right now called Art Blitz. What's that?
Art Blitz is a concept that we came up with based on BioBlitz, which the National Park Service has done. The idea of getting an intense activity of art, people acquainted with the art. We want people to come.
And we want them engaged.
And engaged in art. So we're going to have artists of all kinds, musicians, painters, pottery, hands-on activities that families can come and grown-ups can come and play with art outside.
Yep, pick up a new skill.
And so a lot of activities will be going on at the same time.
Many volunteer artists as we can rope into doing this for us.
Is Art Blitz a one-day activity?
It will be a weekend activity, the 16th and 17th of September. And so both days, starting at 10 and going to about 7 o'clock sundown. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like it's a great setting. And so a lot of, and you don't even know yet how many in all. You're still involved with the recruiting part.
Yes.
Part of the process. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I think that so people of all ages can participate in these activities.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's a little bit like the programs that I think were encouraged when Indiana celebrated its bicentennial last year, and the Indiana Arts Commission and the State Parks Service had a grant program, which they are continuing beyond the bicentennial, for artists to be engaging the public in arts activities in the state parks.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's similar to that, and it's kind of similar in some way to the old Sunflower Festival that used to go on at the Art Barn, but it's different.
Oh, I remember that. I think that's what Jan came to talk about.
Yes, yeah, so we're going to try to stay away from things like chicken drops and country active betting on,
So, Claire, how can people get more information and participate with you?
Well, they can go to our website, www.artbarnschool.org.
Okay.
And our information is listed there. Our phone number, 219-462-9009.
And you're the person to contact for that aspect of it, for volunteering at the helping out that
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
That's good. Well, I think it sounds like a really fun day. And, I want you to come back and talk about other Art Barn activities in the near future so we know more about it.
Yes, we have all kinds of exciting workshops going on and classes and other things going
on. Okay, well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, next visit. Thank you for being here, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
John Kane was talking with Julie Hallmass, who's the Vice President of Events and Programs and Classes, and Claire Reed, who is the Volunteer Coordinator of the Art Barn's Art Blitz, which is coming up on September 16th and 17th, just outside Valparaiso. You can hear this conversation and other Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and tune in next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We hope you'll be with us here tomorrow.